Well, thanks for having me here. First, I want to thank Professor Romanovich and Professor Shubinev for organizing the workshop. Today, I'm going to talk about some recent work done in my group at Caltech about deep earthquakes, in particular about how to image the existence of metastatic body weight in slabs and how would that impact our understanding of deep earthquake physics. I would also like to revive this idea of more than one mechanism for deep earthquakes with some new observations. But before, by the way, when I say deep earthquake here, I'm talking about earthquake deeper than 300 kilometer depth. Sometimes we call that deep focus earthquake. But before I start, I want to show this photo. Have any of you see this phenomena, meteorology phenomena? It's called a punch hole cloud. It's like someone punched a hole in the cloud, and there is even rainfall within that little cloud. This cloud exists because the little water droplet in the cloud is actually in a supercooled condition. It's actually below freezing temperature, but it lacks the kind of nucleation need to form water droplet, okay, large droplet. So it's in a metastable stage, okay. And then when something perturbs that cloud, either it's a wave propagating or airplane travels through that cloud, it triggered the nucleation, and suddenly a big chunk of cloud suddenly start to rain, and you form this punch hole cloud. Well, how does this relate to this topic, this workshop? Well, I believe this left figure would be the same picture of the workshop. One big component of this image is the existence of metastable Audubon. Okay, so metastable Audubon is in the middle of the slab, which is inhibited, the Audubon to spinel phase change are temporarily inhibited by the lower temperature, forming this metastable Audubon wedge, and later a sudden phase change, a transformation faulting of the metastable material could be the cause of deep earthquakes. Okay, so this has been one of the leading hypotheses for deep earthquake. And the figure to the right shows, there are many, many experiments. I think that's probably the most important thing about this transmission faulting. There is a lot of experimental support of this hypothesis. Okay, so the figure to the right is a more recent experiment by Professor Shubinev using germanium olivine. So when you compress germanium olivine to high pressure and temperature, you do see acoustic emission coming out from the sample. And then later, wonderful thing about experiment, you can take out the sample, you can open up the sample, you can see what is happening inside there. So over the figure A, you can actually see those slant traces, where are the fault, where the acoustic emission happened. And then you zoom in a small block, you can see the white markers are offset by the fault by a large distance. And then if you further zoom in near the fault zone, you can actually see the changed phase, the spinel, very thin layer around the fault. So this is a very good proof of this transmission faulting mechanism actually works under this kind of pressure and temperature. Okay, but then the major problem now is, does metastable Audubon wedge actually exist inside Earth? Okay, if it doesn't exist inside the Earth, we couldn't use it to explain deep earthquakes. Okay, so there have been many, many attempts in the last tens of years try to find evidence for metastable Audubon, and there are many, many examples. To the right, to the left, people are like in favor of this existence, and the figure to the right, they will say, well, there's no way using your current approach you can see that, in your frequency band or using the kind of waves you're looking for. Okay, so there's a lot of debate about this. I think probably everyone here would have a different opinion on that. I'm not going to go through all the study here, just focus on one, the one by Kawakatsu and Yoshioka are using receiver functions. For me personally, that's probably one of the most convincing one. But even for this one, receiver function one, so you can see how they interpret, that slant tiered layer of blue and red on the receiver function as a metastable Audubon. But in the same area, two other studies using almost the same station, the same data, could come up with images with different features or different interpretations, right? So this is really showing the debate in this field about existence of metastable Audubon. Well, first of all, I want to give you an intuitive explanation why, especially to all those non-seismologists, why is it so difficult to confirm the existence of metastable Audubon, that MOW layer. Well, seismologists, we use seismographs. We have to see the feature on the seismographs to see what, whether they exist. So figure to the right, I try to show you a synthetic example where I simulate two cases, one with metastable artery, one without, okay, with everything else being the same, show you the influence of this low velocity layer in the middle of slab. Usually we think of MOW as a triangular layer with a lower velocity than the surrounding material, maybe on the order of 5% slower. Okay, so I have a slab, I have a very shallow layer, like top 200 of the Earth being highly scattering. Now I have an earthquake at about 600 kilometer depths. I look at the waveform at a shallow receiver on the surface. So the black and red traces show the two seismographs. You can see there are differences. Okay, so now let's see if you're a seismologist who uses travel times to try to find the MOW, then you will be out of luck. Okay, first, there were trade-off with the location of earthquake. Even if you don't have the trade-off, like here, we know perfectly where the location is, you can see the two earthquakes, two seismographs at 125 seconds, the travel time are barely different. Okay, this is because the low velocity layer in the middle of the Earth, the wave could actually propagate around the low velocity layer and catch up. This is what we call the wavefront heating effect. You won't see a thing about the low velocity layer if it's very thin. Okay, then we need to rely on waveforms. If you filter these two waveforms to very long periods, say 5 seconds or longer, again, you won't see a thing because this is such a thin layer that the signal will completely disappear. But if you look at high frequency, here is around 1 hertz, indeed, you see a big difference. Okay, especially the Kodo wave are highly different. But in real Earth, we actually don't know what the shallow scattering structures are. Okay, so there are many ways, non-unique ways, to interpret this high-frequency complexity as either due to metastable artery or maybe more easily as a shallow structure being too complicated or more complicated than we thought. Okay, so this is really the major difficulty. So then when we look at this problem, we say, well, maybe we can be a little bit different if we have an array on the surface of the Earth, and we can find another earthquake, which I call shallow, meaning still about 400 kilometer depths, then you can potentially find a station that have a repath from the deep earthquake traveling across the slightly shallower earthquake. Okay? Then they would sample the same shallow structure, and you look at the waveform difference, can tell you something about the structure between these two earthquakes, which could be, you know, where the metastable artery wedge would sit. Okay, so that's the basic idea. And of course, this is not like a brand new idea. Quantitatively, this goes back to seismic interferometry. Many of you maybe know this thing about NB noise, the cross correlation. If you have two stations, you're surrounded by noise from the ocean or earthquakes, CODA, you can do cross correlation of the two stations, as in the left figure, get the Green's function between the two. Okay, then by reciprocity, if you have two earthquakes, and then you have a station surrounding the two earthquakes, then you may be able to cross-correlate the waveform at all the stations to get the Green's function between the two earthquakes. So this is the inter-source interferometry. This way, we can eliminate the effect of all the shallow structures around the, you know, around the Earth, and then focus on what we are really interested in. Okay, but one, of course, difficulty of this is you need Earth stations surrounding your two earthquakes, and clearly we don't have that. We only have earthquake stations on the surface of the Earth, but well, let's give it a try. Let's see if we can figure this out. Okay, so Japan is where we have the most stations, so this is probably our best chance for doing that. Still, you can see if we find some red event showing as red, that is the deeper one. These are around 400 kilometer ones. I draw a line, and all the stations are around one side of their, the distribution. So this is not a very ideal situation. So I'm trying to do some synthetic tests to show whether that geometry is enough. Okay, so this is the same kind of simulation I showed you before. So now I have two sources, and I have a bunch of stations, and I have the two waveforms, from one from the deeper, one from the shallow one. Now I cut the P wave from these two earthquakes, and I do cross correlation at every station. Then in the right figure, the middle figure, I show each trace is a cross correlation of the P wave at a particular station. Okay, I have a certain amount of stations, I stack them together, I hope to get the Green's function between the two, which theoretically should look like that, should look like the top red one. That's the true Green's function in this case. And you can see we did a really poor job, the cross correlation doesn't even look remotely similar to the true Green's function. This is because of the station coverage. Okay, we don't have stations covering enclosing the two earthquakes. But then we found that you have all these coda waves. Okay, those coda waves are actually scattered in the shallow medium. So in some sense, they are virtual receivers there. Okay, so if you take the coda wave and you cross-grade that part, it's as if any scatter in the shallow part of the Earth acts as your source, a station now. Right? So the figure to the right is the same synthetics, but not just cross-grading the coda wave. Now you can see each station is actually giving you a much better cross-correlation. When you stack them, it looks almost the same in terms of the main arrival as the predicted Green's function. Okay? And the fact that all stations show the same waveforms tells you that the scattering is actually very efficient. No matter where your station is, it's all being smeared in the shallow Earth, that it doesn't matter where the station actually sits. It can give you a very good recovery of the Green's function between the two earthquakes. So this is wonderful. We can potentially use this, right? And also, what if there is no metastable olivine? I cannot pre-decide there must be metastable olivine. If there is no metastable olivine, then I can do the same thing. And I found that, again, if you use direct way, you cannot get anything. Okay, but if you use the coda way, you do get another receiver, Green's function that is very close to the true receiver function. Okay, so if there is no metastable olivine, we can also see the difference. You may notice that the figure before and after, the predicted waveform are different. That is actually the true Green's function between the two earthquakes, due to the existence of metastable olivine. Why are they different? So the top one is what you would have with no metastable olivine, the Green's function between the two earthquakes. The bottom one is there's no metastable olivine. Oh, this is without metastable, this is with metastable olivine. So you can see the wave are very delayed, but again, we don't know the exact location of earthquake. We cannot count on their timing, but you can see there is a waveform difference. If you know metastable olivine, it will be mostly a positive pulse. If there is a metastable olivine, it will be a positive swing plus a big negative pulse. Why is it like that? So if you do a simulation, look at the wave field, now you can see the low velocity metastable olivine actually have trapped waves inside the wedge, which give you this interference in the end that leads this to complex waveform look like that. Okay, so next one, I will be trying to look for this kind of signal in real data, see which one actually fits the predictions better. So we basically find this resolution sums come out very low, but we actually find a couple of pairs in Japan, and we do cross-correlation. This one, each one here is one station's cross-correlation, and remarkably, this image looks quite similar to that in terms of the move-out. It's basically straight up and down, again, showing the effect of strong scattering in shallow Earth. And when you stack them together, you get this waveform here, which shows you a mostly negative pulse. And to us, that is the evidence for the existence of metastable olivine in this area. Okay, and this is after canceling out all the complexity in the shallow Earth. Okay, and we not only have this, we also have tried that if this cannot be due to just a thin low velocity layer on top of the slab, right? So some people may say, could this be a hydrated layer, of a serpentine and have a phase change into larger depths, still have a low velocity layer, but it's not in the middle of the slab? If you have that, it gives you the waveform shown as the brown one here. Again, that is actually pretty similar to a thermal slab, but what I observe is a waveform like that. Okay? This is actually not our only pair. We have a few other pairs. They all show a mostly negative waveform, maybe a slight positive swing in front of the negative one. Okay, so this is great. This is the waveform filter at 2 Hz. We think we see the existence of metastable olivine wedge in the middle of the slab. What about the exact geometry of metastable olivine? How thick it is? What's the orientation of that layer? Well, that we have to go to higher frequency. So this, again, is to show a synthetic example of what we should expect. If you have a wedge here, you have an earthquake on this side, and you have a bunch of earthquake at these depths, at a different distance from the top of the slab, this would be the profile, what you should expect. Unfortunately, we don't really have earthquakes near the very bottom of the slab, which is very warm, so we can only look at the distance around 0 to 60 kilometers from the top, maybe. Or here, this is the 2 Hz one, what I showed you before, mostly have this negative and slightly positive pulse. But if you look at the 5 Hz case, you can see, depending on where you are, you could actually get in double arrivals. Okay, so the wave you know, reflected back and forth inside the wedge can give you two arrivals depending on where you are. So we also look for that. Well, this is actually the high frequency cross correlation of the Kodak wave around up to five hertz. And you sometimes see this simple waveform with a negative and a positive swing, which is as predicted in, from synthetics. But sometimes you actually see you know, this double parse. Okay, so the gray color shows you the 95, you know, bootstrapping uncertainty of that. So we think this double arrival is actually real. What this tells us is that by looking at a bunch of earthquakes at 400 kilometer depth, we actually see a variation of waveform, which could be due to relative location of that earthquake, you know, to the metastable bottoming. So we are currently in the process of trying to figure out, you know, how to get a constraint on the exact size of the metastable bottoming, see that whether that would be consistent with the mineral physical and the thermal modeling of slabs. So more to come in the AGU meeting if you are going there. But now the question is, okay, looks like we can do this. Maybe we spend another 1 or 2 years, we can, you know, get a good model here, and we can try some other subduction zones. And we may find the metastable bottoming in other places. Are we done with this problem? Are we solving this deep earthquake problem here? Okay, I would say no, because there are still problems even if you observe metastable bottoming. Okay, one major problem that I would highlight is about the size of metastable bottoming compared to the dimension of rupture we have observed. Okay, one big question is always for South America, where you have the Bolivia earthquake ruptured at least 30 kilometers in dimension. There's no way the metastable bottoming can be that thick at that depth. You have to rupture away from the metastable bottoming. Okay, so this is actually a question. I hope there will be some discussion today about the condition metastable bottoming can exist. But during that discussion, I think we should keep in mind that deep earthquake rupture is actually fairly diverse. There's many, many different kinds of rupture in deep earthquakes. So I would highlight this diversity in terms of radiation efficiency. So I will first give you a brief definition of what I'm talking about. Earthquake, of course, a stress drop event, right? So after a certain sleep, the stress dropped from sigma one to sigma two, and the stress drop can be measured based on seismic measurement as long as you have the magnitude of the earthquake and the L dimension of the earthquake. Okay, so if a big earthquake concentrating a very small dimension, you have a very high stress drop event. And this dependence on L is very strong, it's to the power of 3. So small change in the dimension can cause large difference in stress drop. The gray area to the figure in the left, the trapezoid, tells you the total energy release during the earthquake. Unfortunately, we don't really know what's the absolute value of earthquakes. So we couldn't constrain the lower, you know, rectangle, the EF portion, the friction heating part. What we can constrain is the blue triangle, which we called the available strain energy, which you can calculate if you know the moment of the earthquake and the stress drop of the earthquake. Okay, out of that part of the energy, a portion of that is radiated as a seismic wave, which we can observe on the surface of the Earth. That one we can estimate as radiated energy. So it's interesting to ask, you know, what's the fraction of the radiated energy compared to the total available strain energy? Okay, so this is the so-called radiation efficiency parameter. It's just the ratio between the two, usually between 0 and 1. Sometimes you can get above 1. So that tells you if it's close to 0, most of the energy are dissipated near the source, or if it's close to 1, means that most of the energy gets radiated. It's a very brittle event. Okay. And sometimes a brittle event gives you very high rupture speed compared to the shear wave speed, and the dissipated one will give you a very low rupture speed. So these are the features we can observe in seismic observations. Well, I'm not going into the details of several earthquakes, but in the last couple of years, we have been studying a few very large deep earthquakes, and I see a general pattern. Okay, I see a general pattern there. There are earthquakes that are very, you know, brittle, very efficient. In particular, there 2013, there is a 6.7 Okhotsk earthquake. We think it's actually a super shear earthquake. That makes, you know, you have to be very efficient to accelerate the rupture front to be super shear. But we also see earthquakes in 1994, Bolivia 8.2 earthquake, which seems to only have a few percent of the energy being radiated, most of them dissipated. So that would be all the way in the right part of the figure being very dissipating. Okay, and we see a wide range of distribution in between too. Okay, and more interestingly, we found that for almost all earthquakes that seems to be dissipating, their initial part is always brittle. Even for the 1994 Bolivia earthquake, which lasts about 30 seconds long, most of the moment was in the later 20 seconds of the earthquake. That's the really dissipative part. But the first 10 seconds I would divide in the Bolivia number one, is which the first 10 seconds, which turns out to have a pretty high rupture speed. So that means it's actually kind of brittle. There are several other examples like that too, like the earthquake Professor Kuge just talked about, the Bowling Island earthquake. It seems to be very slow, but if you look at the very beginning of the earthquake, it ruptures very fast at about at least 5 kilometers per second towards the east direction. So again, making it very brittle. So we see this pattern of very diverse rupture, but there is a transition from brittle to ductile kind of deformation regime, right? So we may need a different mechanism for this kind of diverse properties. You know, at what the experiment showed, you know, when Alex Schubiner opened up the sample, you don't see melting on the sample. That means this process is actually very brittle and spontaneous. That could be very easily used to explain the brittle end of the spectrum. But the earthquake to the right, you probably need something very different. And of course, this has been discussed before, because once you have so much energy being dissipated near the source, there is almost no way you can avoid melting at the source. So for example, the Bolivia earthquake, given the stress drop, you can calculate the available strain energy, and that available strain energy turns out to be the same, about the same order as the eruption Mount St. Helens, which lasts a couple of days, but all of that energy is really dissipated near the fault of the Bolivia earthquake within 30 seconds, and you don't have any time to dissipate it away, diffuse away from the fault. So you're gonna melt a layer of rock at least tens of centimeters. So there's almost no way to avoid that, right? So given this kind of understanding, I'm going to basically try to revive this idea of that deep earthquake may have more than one mechanisms, okay? But this time, because you involve more complexity here, I hope we can make it more testable. So I try to formulate it as a very specific hypothesis that can potentially be tested in the future. What I say is deep earthquakes initiate with transformation faulting and may propagate with the same mechanism, or it may trigger shear melting to continue the rupture. Okay? So this is, you know, earthquake must start with a spontaneous metastable phase change, but if it's big enough, it can trigger melting, okay, it may propagate later with the second mechanism. That, of course, can easily be used to explain why earthquake rupture are so diverse. So for example, the Bolivia Okhotsk earthquake, which is in a cold slab, this is the cross-section view of the fault. You may have a thick metastable audible, which the blue zone earthquake can propagate back and forth within the blue zone and being efficient all the time. While to the right, if you have in warm slag, the metastable audible is very, very thin. So initially, you may propagate along the metastable audible wedge, but then if you trigger something big, it can go away from the wedge and rupture the warmer part of the slab, and then being slow and inefficient, right? But one thing to keep in mind here, this is not talking about a deterministic process. This is more like a probabilistic process. It's not like we have a guarantee that an earthquake in a cold slab will always be in the wedge, while an earthquake in the warm slab will always trigger melting, right? That's not the case. I think like 3 months ago, I'm always almost confused by this, for this Tonga earthquake, but then I sort of figured out what is happening. So I'm gonna switch gear to talk about this earthquake and how does that fit into this hypothesis here. Well, many of you know Fiji-Tonga is the coldest subduction zone in the world, has been producing most of the deep earthquake we have observed, right? So the figure to the left is showing the Gutenberg-Richter distribution, and the green curve here is for Tonga, and the other one is for all other subduction zones combined together, okay? So even if you're looking at only up to magnitude 5.3, Tonga is producing a few times more earthquakes than any other subduction, all other subduction zones combined. If you go to USGS catalog, go to lower magnitude, you will be tens of times more than all the other ones combined. But ironically, it never had its own big one. Okay, so if you look at the earthquakes above magnitude 6.5 or 7, you know, actually other subductions are producing more squeaks than Tonga. This is because of a difference in B value. Oh, by the way, this is one of the papers in 2007. I point out there is actually a clear kink in the Gutenberg distribution for the other warmer subduction zone, which again is evidence for the Stewart-Mackinnon hypothesis, because the break suggests there is a break of same similarity. So there may be a switch of mechanism, but I'm not going into the details of that. Okay, so this ironic, you know, reality for Tonga just changed 3 months ago. August 19th, the magnitude 8.2 earthquake happened in Tonga at about 560 kilometer depths. That's the yellow star here. And then about 2 weeks later, another 7.9 earthquake happened much deeper, about 250 kilometers to the west and 650 kilometer depths. Turns out the 7.9 happened in an area with very low background seismicity, so it's very likely that this 7.9 is related to the 8.2 earthquake. Okay, I can show you some figure about that later. But the key information here is being an earthquake in the coldest subduction zone, if we take, you know, rigidly, okay, cold subduction zone means more brittle material, then we'd expect the radiation efficiency for these two earthquakes to be much, much higher than any of the other large earthquakes in warmer subduction zones. And then we did an energy estimate of the radiated energy. It turns out, after you scale with the moment, so the scaled energy, these two earthquakes are not high at all compared to other large deep earthquakes, even to Bolivia. Okay? So this in first sight seems to be surprising. It doesn't seem to radiate more seismic energy than other ones. Okay, of course, that's not the full story. Real radiated energy only depends on radiated energy, but also on your total available strain energy. And given the moment being similar to Okhotsk and Bolivia, what do we need to figure out, what's the stress drop? Okay, and stress drop is going to depend strongly on the rupture dimension of this earthquake. So what we need to figure out is the rupture dimension of this earthquake being comparable to Okhotsk, then it will be a brittle event. If it's very small, like Bolivia, then it's going to be a very dissipative event. So that's what we need to figure out. Okay, so I apply the same method we have always been using for deep earthquake, the sub-event method, basically explain a large earthquake as a sequence of sub-event. Okay, so there turns out these two earthquakes are both very complicated. So the dot here are showing the rupture process of 8.2. It started here and first rupture towards the northeast direction, and then it turned to rupture to the northwest direction. And the moment tensor here, the size is proportional to the moment. So most of the sub-event in this second stage, northwest rupture, are the biggest sub-event. The earlier ones are actually pretty small, 7.5. Smaller, okay? So, and you can see, interestingly, the focal mechanism of these ones, E1, E3, or maybe E2, they have a strike that is more towards the east. When you go to 4, 5, 6, the strike sort of turned towards the north direction. So there is a significant change in the moment tensor along the earthquake rupture, and that can be seen pretty clearly on these four seismograms from different azimuths. You can see some of them, all the parts are positive, and some of them, all the positives are negative. But in between, you get a switch. Some of them become positive, another one becoming negative. That is because there are something different part of the focal sphere, and because the difference in radiation pattern, one becoming, you know, switching the sign first compared to the others. So you see this change of focal mechanism. So I think this change of moment tensor along the rupture is pretty convincing. When we sum them up, we can actually explain about 10% of the CRVD that are observed in this, for this earthquake very well. The 7.9 earthquake is also fairly complicated, have two small sub-events first, and then most of the rupture occurred towards the northeast direction, so these are the big sub-event, and they also have a fairly diverse moment tensor. When you add them together, again, we explain the 30% CRVD very well. Okay, but that's not what I'm talking about. There is actually more story here about their rupture process. What's important is their rupture dimension, what we really want to know. Okay, here I'm plotting the sub-event model for the two Fiji earthquake together with Okhotsk and Bolivia at the same scale here. Okay, and you immediately you notice that their rupture dimension are not large at all. They are not like a 100-kilometer rupture dimension like the Okotsk earthquake. They are more like a rupture dimension about maybe 30 in this dimension, 40 in this dimension, or maybe this one, the largest of even all within 40 kilometers. That is actually fairly similar to the Bolivia earthquake. Okay, that is the surprise. Okay, so large earthquake, small dimension, high stress drop, very similar radiated energy. So these two earthquakes in the world coldest subduction zone actually looks like as dissipative as the Bolivia earthquake, which is in a very warm subduction zone. How could that happen? Okay. So this is what we were confused in the beginning. We decided to dig a little bit deeper into that. It turns out a more in-depth look revealed a very different story. So here again is the sub-event model for this earthquake. Now I overlay on top of that is the background seismicity around these two earthquakes. So to the left and the right of this figure, you have very different color of scale because there is a very the background seismicity is very low around the 7.9 earthquake. But for the 8.2, you see this clear band of seismicity going from northwest to southeast direction. Okay, and the earthquake, the blue line showing the center of the seismicity band, and you can indeed see the earthquake initially started from the center of the band, but it ruptured towards the northeast. It means that they actually ruptured away from the center of the band by about 30 kilometers. Okay, so if we take the center of seismicity band, like what the people did previously, as the center of the slab core, what does that mean to go 30 kilometers away from the center? The figure to the right is the thermal profile produced by Professor Matt Gurnis using some thermal modeling. The blue line there shows you what if you go about 30 kilometers from the central slab. Turns out to that distance, it's about 200 to 300 degrees warmer than the center of the slab. So if you now plot on top of that, the thermal profile expected for the Bolivia case, which is the red one. So there, where this earthquake is rupturing most, the later big sub-event, the temperature there is actually as warm as the Bolivia case. Okay. So even though this is in world coldest subduction zone, most of the rupture is happening in the warmer, lower portion of the slab that is as warm as the world's warmest subduction zone. So we couldn't really just talking about the coldest subduction zone. We need to really talk about where exactly is your earthquake rupturing within the slab. Okay, I'm almost down there. So that is for this 8.2 earthquake. And the aftershock actually support this idea too. So we know that, you know, so this earthquake actually produced hundreds of aftershocks, which is one of the most productive one. It turns out if you plot the distribution, the density of the aftershocks, they are all concentrated near this portion of the earthquake rupture, which is actually the smaller sub-event, or this magnitude 7.5 sub-event. When the earthquake turned to the northwest, where you have also this big sub-event, there's almost no aftershock there compared to the beginning part. Okay? So where you have this distribution is very disproportional. But now we can understand this because the early part is actually in the colder part of the slab, while the later part is in the warmer part of the slab that's less aftershock productive. So that's actually consistent with what people have known. A colder area produces more aftershocks. What about the 7.9 earthquake? The 7.9 earthquake, you can barely see the color here, which is already using a different color bar, that there's very little background seismicity and very few aftershocks. So I would say this is a good example of the isolated large deep earthquake, which I assume Cliff will talk about in a minute. So this very large isolated event, I usually think to thought to be happening in a warm slab where you have probably nucleating, but once it's nucleate, it releases all the stress so you don't have any aftershocks. So how can we find a very warm slab to the side of Tonga? It turns out this is the knowing pretty well that there could be a detached Australian slab next to the Tonga slab. This has been proposed based on seismicity tomography. Actually, in this regional tomography, you can see the Tonga slab, and then you can see this higher velocity piece over here. The contour here actually shows a global model, which also shows this higher velocity piece here. You can see some seismicity, and the tectonic reconstruction also confirms that there could be a piece of Australia slab falling on top of the Tonga slab and being much warmer. So that would be perfectly to explain to why this 7.9 earthquake being an isolated large earthquake. So just to summarize here, I showed a new approach of interferometric imaging seems to reveal the metastable olivine wedge in Japan's lab, and also the diversity of rupture, this brittle to ductile transition, and also magnetic dependence of B value lead me to propose this dual mechanism hypothesis, which is a transmission 14 to begin with, plus a shear melting. And then I showed that the 2018 Fiji magnetic 8 doublet on the first face value seems to contradict our understanding of temperature being the main control of deep earthquake. Turns out, I think it actually confirms that, you know, temperature is the main control, because most of the sleep actually happens either in a warmer part of the slab or in a warm detached slab. Okay, and this could mean that we probably want to stay away, go away from thermal parameter from now on, because that's a very simplistic parameter for entire subduction zone. The reality is more complicated than that. I want to skip this one from Cider, but thank you. This is my collaborations. I will take any questions.
Thank you, Zhongwen.